Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Mad Jin.
A composite show. Archive segments from previous episodes that got cut due to time. Recorded for episode 208 with Dan Q. Makalua, the Mian Team, Mad Jin, and the Grumpy Buddha. Tips for playing Civilization 5. I do want to preface this actually with another article by this author. On the 30th of June, he wrote separately that because I enjoy hurting myself and all those around me, I've gotten back into Civilization 5 recently.
Well,
this is a Luke Plunkett for Kotaku. There are 15, he refers to them as golden rules. Civilization 5 has grown over a few big expansions to become one of the very best games on the PC. I'd go so far as to say it's, gasp, the best Civilization game of them all. To help out newcomers then, or just those who are upgrading with the expansions, I thought I'd put this guide together, letting you know some of the best tips to keep on top of jerks like Gandhi. Wow.
Well.
We're off to a good start.
Humor is appreciated. This isn't a complete and thorough guide to the game. We don't have the space or time for that. Huh, no kidding. Start small and easy.
While it can be tempting to start your first games on a large map, you're better off starting on small or even tiny. The advantage of these sizes is that they not only cut down on the amount of grinding you need to do in terms of expanding and building, but they can also be more interesting games, especially if you cram 6 to 8 civs into them. Ditto for difficulty. Start at the bottom and work your way up. There are enough changes to the fundamental Civ formula with this game that even veterans need to dial it down a bit when learning the ropes. I don't know about that, but I think if you're a Civ veteran, you can probably get by on a middling difficulty. If you're like,
yeah, you don't have to go all the way back down to Chieftain if you've been playing Civ before, but new players probably at least start at Warlord or something. Don't start at the simple easiest because you might get into bad habits.
Yeah, start at Prince, and if you lose, then go down a little.
Yeah. Small maps have a few benefits. Certainly, there's just less ahead planning, I guess, to some degree. But also, if you don't have like a high-end machine, the game will run a bit smoother on the smaller maps.
And you don't have to deal with so many AIs all at once.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. That's a big part of it.
Yeah, if you don't cram the map.
Yeah.
Except he also says, it can be tempting to start your first games on a large map, but then talks about going for the smaller, tiny maps, especially if you cram 6 to 8 civs into them. So I interpreted that as, well, first off, you want to go in and start modifying INI files so you can have more AIs per map than is expected. Whoa. But anyway, I understand the smaller map, and I would also dare suggest that if you're just getting started, in particular with Civ 5, even if you've played previous Civ games before, start with a map that does not have you going onto an ocean, just to try to limit the likelihood that there are going to be some runaway AIs around the world that you're not going to be able to get to until later.
Yeah, I don't think it's really a big deal. Like, this point is nice or whatever, but you can have fun doing pretty much anything at the start, depending on your personality.
And if you fail, well, adjust.
Pretty much.
Well, if you don't fail often enough, then you're probably playing on too easy difficulty level.
Yeah.
Yes.
Expand.
Well, the very first thing you're going to want to do is expand. The most precious thing on a civilization map is real estate. The more cities you have, the more golden resources you generate, the bigger your territory, the more likely you'll be to own the necessary strategic resources. So build settlers earlier, with the odd worker to help build roads between your cities, and when adopting social policies, start with tradition, which grants expansive bonuses. Don't stop expanding until you start losing money and or creating unhappiness.
Other than the last sentence?
Yeah, second last sentence, actually. But
yeah.
Start with tradition? No, if you're trying to expand, start with liberty.
Yeah. You can say expand with tradition, but you don't want to expand very far with tradition.
If you want to expand,
then you go liberty. With something else.
Honor.
Honor.
Or honor.
Also, I think it's really important to try to forward settle on the aggressive civs like Shaka and Attila just to show them who's boss.
Yeah.
And intimidate them.
You definitely want honor.
Yeah, you want them to be afraid of you.
Exactly. So I try to make sure I'm like 4 away from their cap. Because then they understand that I'm there for business. You know what I mean?
Yep. Roll up next to the captain like, oh, hi.
And this is the last sentence. The don't stop expanding until you start losing money.
Or creating unhappiness.
I usually associate one of the good things about expanding is that you start...
with getting more money?
Actually.
Yeah, it takes a little bit before you can start making money off expanding.
Yeah, now that we have the trade routes thing where we actually have to build caravans and stuff, it's not like before where you just connected up the cities and boom.
No, you still have that. But,
yeah, but not...
I guess I was... Well...
But you still have... Even if you do that, you have to wait for the population to get high enough to that the roads between cities
are
is
worth
paid
it.
For. Yeah.
I was thinking more in terms of the losing money part. Oh, I've got a little bit of negative gold per turn here. Or even if you don't have negative gold per turn, when you settle that new city, it's now going to be working a tile. And assuming that tile actually has some gold that you could work, like, say, for example, an unimproved luxury resource, then you're going to start getting a little bit more money.
Don't forget the city hex as well, because that can give you a little bit.
And the city hex too. Yes, that's right. Because you're always working that,
yeah.
You know, unless the city goes away. In which case, you got bigger problems.
You can definitely run yourself into problems if you just keep expanding. Although, I guess if you play in low enough difficulty levels, that's less of a concern.
Yeah.
The creating unhappiness thing with expanding, I'm agreeing a little more than that. And I know he says this is not a complete and thorough guide, but he does say, think of these as some golden rules. And the problem when I hear the word golden rules, as we'll get into some other points, is that that's an absolute.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't treat it as such. But anyway, be happy.
Don't worry.
Be happy.
That last part there about happiness is actually worth its own section. You must always keep your Civ happy. Well, in previous games, having unhappy citizens wasn't that big of a deal. In Civ 5, it can cripple you. At first, you'll suffer reduced production and income, but let things get out of hand and rebels will start popping up and trashing the place. He actually completely misses the fact that you have the growth negative right off the mark as soon as you hit negative one. So, yeah, that's actually big. While focusing on gold and production might seem tempting, especially to veterans of the series, found happiness is the first thing you need to worry about because it's the hardest to stay on top of. Trade routes make income a lot easier.
Yeah, I think I don't know if it's the hardest thing, but the thing you need to stay most on top of is science!
Funding!
Yeah. We'll get to that.
You want to maintain your happiness at zero or above zero, preferably above, so you have ability to grow and not hit negative problems, especially in the later expansions. Things did get changed with the happiness if you start going negative. Getting fairly unhappy is going to basically stop you from growing and continuing to do things. So you need to make sure that you're constantly planting your new city's new luxury resources and getting them improved as fast as possible. It is very, very important to do that and get your happiness to be maintained at least at zero, if not a bit more. Unless he's trying to be all soft and fluffy and just be happy while you play.
One would hope.
And I'm going to introduce Faith. Religion might seem like a bit of fluff, but it can be a powerful diplomatic and cultural weapon, not to mention a good source of happiness for your own people. So, as soon as you're done expanding, focus on building shrines and temples that you can found a religion and start spreading it. If another religion overruns your civ before you've had a chance to found your own, you'll be at a disadvantage for the rest of the game. Okay, as soon as you're done expanding, focus on building shrines and temples. Don't wait until you're done expanding before you do that. I'm not saying it should be the first thing that you build in your new cities. And I'm also taking this on the premise that, you know, he's talking about expand right away to multiple cities as soon as possible, even though that's not my approach. But the thing is, if you wait until you're done expanding, whatever that is, to start focusing on building shrines and temples, you're going to be behind at least one other civ on the map, almost certainly lessening the likelihood that you're going to be able to found a religion. And, oh, look at that. Religions have already been founded otherwise, and they've already spread, and they start spreading to me. And then this, if another religion overruns your civ before you've had a chance to found your own, you may or may not be at a disadvantage. You'll certainly be at a disadvantage in terms of, I got to get this religion out of here. Although, quite honestly, it could also be a disadvantage to you to found a religion really late on the game if what it is that you are looking for, what's best, however you define what's best in terms of beliefs, have already been taken. You could actually use that to your advantage. But if for some reason you start finding that a religion has overrun your civ and you've found a religion and you believe, you know, to be true that the beliefs that you have founded are what you want in your cities or some of your cities, then just counter that and start sending out the great prophets, maybe even the inquisitors. His time focus, and then he just kind of seems to give up in the end that there's a point where you just kind of have to wash your hands of faith if you get too far behind. And I don't think you have to wash your hands if you get too far behind. And I think he's kind of setting himself up to get far behind anyway.
You don't have to found a religion to be fine in the game. You're not at a disadvantage. Yes, you don't get the founder bonus. Yes, you don't control where it goes and what it does.
But if the religion that overruns your civ has bonuses per city or population that work, then somebody else spent all their faith on that, and you don't have to. So you can just plant great prophets to get more faith per turn, and then utilize their religion. And when in doubt, just go kill them, take the holy city, and then you can still get all the bonuses, except for the founder stuff.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, there are times when an AI founds a religion, whether it's before or after me, it spreads to one of my cities, and I'm thinking, yes, because you took the building, thinking specifically with buildings thing here. If you found Buddhism and someone else founds Catholicism, Catholicism spreads to you, and hey, look at this, I can now build cathedrals with faith. Go ahead, build a cathedral with faith, then convert your city to Buddhism, and look at that, you still have the cathedral, you still have that benefit, so it can actually be advantageous where you can have your cake and eat it too.
I remember one game where I missed out on desert folklore, plus one faith per tile, and then I got spammed by Arabia, and I was so happy. So happy.
Thanks for the desert folklore, guys.
Which I will now use against you.
Research? It's tough to pick one dominant research path since it really varies depending on your playstyle, but related to my expansion point above, I found the most beneficial to your long-term success is to be the first to get navigation?
What? Go, go.
That's a typo. He meant education. Whoever can venture across the seas first, potentially finding whole new and empty continents or at least strategically advantageous islands where you can double the size of your empire, has an enormous advantage over those civs stuck in the old country.
Sounds like he's playing a Terra map.
Yeah, play only Terra map.
And frankly, if you're playing Pangaea or any of the map types that don't have significant water, getting to navigation is not exactly high on the list of things to do.
Yeah, that's just don't listen to that.
I guess even on some things, frigates are extremely potent, especially for, you know, if they can actually shoot things and you boost them with bombard, they're actually better than pretty much everything for a while so that you can trash a lot of stuff. But that kind of assumes that you're going to have water on the map.
Yeah, okay, so archipelago as well, for sure, then.
It's also going to assume you have access to iron, either natively or through trade, city-state alliances.
And to explore, find whole new and empty continents, astronomy is good enough.
Yeah, there's that little caravel thing.
Your little settlers can just do a long swim. You can't see me right now, but I'm pantomiming swimming.
Ooh.
Research, basically, what is your map type? What will give you an advantage? Obviously, education, quite important, given all the boosts that the university gives. Very important to get it as early as you can, assuming that you're not currently getting face-rolled by some AI.
That.
And therefore, you need to be in the other side of the tech tree.
Yeah.
And if you are, well, getting up through to crossbows at machinery, or longswords if you happen to have iron, or just go straight to civil service and have pikes that'll laugh at most of that stuff for a long time.
Yeah, and civil service is on the way to education anyway.
Yeah, see? And then therefore you have stuff. If you have lands that require specialized tile improvements, then you're going to want to go get that. Otherwise, get to education and then look at what's going on and what your victory condition plan is, and then consider going for the things that help you with that.
Yeah, so to Luke, any general tip, any golden rule that you are going to give that is so situationally based on a particular map type is not a golden rule.
Yeah.
And on that note...
Finish what you started!
Finish what you started. When it comes to social policies, it can be tempting to pick and choose from everything that's on offer. Don't. If you start down one tree, finish it. You might get the occasional boost from grabbing one policy from each choice, but you'll only get the really good bonuses by completing an entire social policy branch.
Well, we have different things going on here. There's some things where you want to hold off finishing for timing.
Yeah.
But then there's also, in the early game, if you open Liberty, finish it. You're going to get a great person out of it. Don't go wandering off into other trees.
Really not a golden rule.
Yeah.
It really, really depends on what you're doing. If you open tradition, you probably want to finish it as quickly as possible so you can get your aqueducts, though you may want to not finish it until you get your fourth city planted so that you can have four free aqueducts right off the mark. But if you go Liberty Opening or Honor Opening, you don't have to finish them right off the mark. You can mix and match.
Yeah, and if you got a policy to dump into patronage or aesthetics or commerce, and then rationalism opens up as a possibility, you don't want to finish patronage before you open rationalism.
Once you start hitting the mid-game to late-game, yeah, you sort of just want to pick the things that will give you the boost. And since all policy trees have a wonder associated to them, if you open exploration because you're going culture, you don't have to finish it. You can, and you get a bonus from it, but you want to do is open it so you can build the wonder.
Yeah.
But then move on. Definitely don't want to take that concept into ideologies, because once you open ideologies, what, the only thing you're going to do is pick ideologies from then on in? It's not necessarily true either.
Yeah. Yes, there's definitely the argument about, oh, you went ahead and opened this social policy because why, when you could have gone farther down another social policy and gotten that particular advantage. But Luke seems so narrow focused here on getting to the very end that the end of the social policy tree is not necessarily, not even the be-all and end-all, but what's most advantageous for you as well as in the moment. There may also be times where, yes, it's going to be advantageous to finish tradition, but maybe not right away. Maybe because you haven't quite done some other step that it's actually more advantageous to go open something else or go farther down another social policy that you've already opened and then come back and finish what you actually have started. So there's a lot of nuance in here that's just, well, absolute statements are absolutely problematic. So to say you only get the really good bonuses by completing an entire social policy branch, that is ouch.
That also assumes that each social policy branch has the good bonus at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say with tradition, it's awesome because you get growth, you get aqueducts, and you get to buy great engineers with your faith, which is awesome. Aesthetics for the end game, being able to buy those great musicians so you can send in Elvis with his nukes, that's also great.
Now, Luke does note in the preface to this article that this guide was originally published in 2013 and has been updated to add more tips and cover advances in tactics and mods. I think what you forgot to do maybe here, Luke, is not just add to your tips, but also go over the tips you've already had, because in some patches and also through some expansions, we've seen some social policy benefits, like the ones that you get at the end, get moved sooner or also the other way around. So maybe this finishing this entire social policy branch, depending upon the social policy you're talking about, maybe it used to be more advantageous to actually get to the end, like to actually complete it. But even then still, I think that was a bit too far to go.
Trade. Don't ignore the new trade route system in Brave New World. If you've got 4 available trade routes, build 4 caravans or 4 cargo ships. If you've 12, build 12. You'll not only make bucketloads of money from this, but it's also a good way to spread your religion and get a slight science boost as well. If you can keep trade gold flowing from the majority of the game, by the industrial and modern age, you'll have thousands in gold.
Well, that's not really true, because if you're making that much money off trade,
you better be spending
before
it.
The industrial era, then what are you doing?
What level are you playing on?
I think we can all agree on the first sentence. Don't ignore the new trade route system in Brave New World.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I agree with the second and third sentences as well.
Yes.
Actually, I don't necessarily agree with them, because if all your neighbors are jerks,
you can still start
building
states.
Neither of those things. Internal trade routes for growth, especially with cargo ships, are so massively powered. I mean, in the Renaissance, you're getting +9 food from a cargo ship. Holy crap. I'm a huge fan of using almost all of my trade routes for internal growth, going to the cap, so...
Yeah, I have a big bonus on that, too.
For a different reason than Majin, actually, I also disagree with the second and third sentences, and that's because it's assuming up front to me that if you build the trade routes, you're going to be able to keep it, because there are these things called barbarians that really wreck your day. When it comes to your trade routes, I realize this is more earlier on. However, certainly with the cargo ships, even once you've cleared the barbarians across the land and you have secured the land on a lot of type of maps, you know, all it takes is one hex in the middle of relatively nowhere for a barbarian camp to spawn. And then they also get naval routes and squish. To me, if you're going to build trade routes, make sure, or at least take reasonable steps to ensure that you're going to be able to protect them, because then if they get plundered, then you're going to have to turn around and build that caravan or cargo ship again, plus something in order to be able to protect it. So eliminate one of those three steps, have protection, build trade routes, and keep trade routes, and not have to do the trade routes again.
Yeah, and, well, frankly, if you're building a trade route, yes, for the most part, you should prioritize building trade routes fairly quickly. once you have them open, but also you have to keep in mind what else you need to build at the time, because they do take away time to build for your production. So there could be something better, like universities, that you would want to build instead of that caravan.
I will say that one thing that Luke doesn't even touch upon here as a golden rule, and you kind of touched on it already, Kyle, was internal versus external trade routes.
Especially in higher difficulty levels, because of the way that the code is written, a trade route to an AI deity will net you a lot of science.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you toss out a couple of those, and all of a sudden, your science pace is such that you're hitting those new happiness buildings and other such related tech earlier than you were before.
Immortal, too, because that helps lessen the derp bonuses that we're now giving the AI at those higher difficulty levels. Helps try to keep you on par with that.
Also keeps them from hating you, because if you have trade routes and they're sending you trade routes, they're less likely to declare war early. Because
most of them, anyway.
Well, some. Yeah. Probably about two, maybe.
View those trade routes as an insurance policy.
Yep.
It's not that they necessarily like you. They just don't dislike you as much as perhaps somebody else. And that's all it can take. It's like a crime of opportunity in a parking lot. Going around, what cars? This person hasn't locked this particular vehicle. A criminal is probably going to want to try to see what they can take from that car as opposed to a car that's locked. So protect yourself.
Dan's practiced the parking lot a lot.
I know that's what it sounds like, but it's just actually that I've studied these things.
No, it's true, and they'll be more likely to declare friendship with you too, which is awesome if you've got a bunch of stuff that you can sell for 240 gold a pop. So,
yeah, basically, you can go external trade routes early, push yourself to the point where you've got the tech that you need to build stuff, and then switch to internal trade routes to actually build all that stuff. Don't forget to flip back and forth. Just because you set a trade route to external or internal doesn't mean that it needs to be there permanently. That's actually more important.
Moving on to grease the palms.
Previously, city-states were something to be tolerated or even ignored. No longer, now that they count as voters in the World Congress, the player can ally themselves to the most city-states as a massive advantage. Yes, that was actually true before, too. Whether they're actively pursuing a diplomatic victory or just want to screw other players over. Yeah, you always did that. The easiest way to do this is ignore their requests. Simply stockpile your trade coal. By the time the World Congress starts getting important later in the game, you can just buy their votes. Yeah, the easiest way is to blatantly ignore city-states because, you know, it's not like they give you stuff if you finish their quest or anything.
You don't need any of that happiness or luxuries or what. No.
I hate 13 culture a turn.
Maybe if we replace easiest with least micro-intensive, but even then that doesn't make it good advice.
I really tried in this paragraph to follow what he was saying, even though, like you, I didn't agree with this. City-states were something to be tolerated or even ignored. Previously or presently, no, I disagree with that. But okay, he now says we're not to ignore them. Okay, that's great. But then he talks about ignore their quests and requests. But I thought you just said we weren't supposed to ignore them. So it hurt. I don't understand that.
Okay, here, let's rewrite this. City-states are useful in the World Congress now because there are votes on a periodic time frame. As in, you can come up with a vote that will change the game every 30 or less turns, depending on what area you're in. Do not ignore city-states. People who have better votes will get their individual proposals through. So do not ignore them. Do the requests. Spend money on them. That way you can do things like get your religion in as the world religion and get boosts. You also get diplomatic votes. The concept of just waiting till the end and buying all the city states, yes, you can do it, but it's going to hurt you in the end because there are things and steps along the way that will give you an easier time to actually win the game by diplomacy. And even if you're not going diplomacy, you still want to grease the palms and get all the city-states before the end of the game to be your allies to vote for you so that you can pass other such resolutions.
Yeah. Kyle was saying, oh, geez, you know, I would absolutely love 13 culture a turn from being a cultural city-state ally. If you not just tolerate, but if you entertain, I would use the term entertain city-states, especially now when we don't have to necessarily dump a whole bunch of gold into them. We can get through quests and requests. So I think, of course, the differentiation there, a request being, oh, go ahead and construct this wonder, or give me a trade route, or build me a road.
Well, request could also be, that guy just stole our cash. Can you please, you know, denounce them?
Yeah, please. The most cultural output or the most faith generation of any particular civilization over X number of turns, and then we will reward you with influence. If you want to better position yourself to be a city-state ally, on multiple city-state allies, if you cultivate those relationships before, not only is that going to be exponential towards having their votes in the World Congress, but you get all these other benefits before, depending upon the type of city-state. It could be happiness from mercantile, food from maritime, etc. So then you better position yourself to actually live to see the World Congress. I suppose I'm generalizing here a little bit, but again, these are general golden rules. Yeah, there's definitely a disconnect in that paragraph, even if we can agree with what has been said at the outset, and we can't even get there. And from that, roads. Don't just build roads between your cities. Build them densely around areas you muster your armies. Build them on coastal areas between continents you might need to launch an invasion from. Build them to nearby city-states. If you've got open border treaties with your neighbors, build them to your cities. Why? Because eventually you're going to go to war with them and conquer them, and having cities in the middle of a war and everything your units are kept, letting them deploy faster, is a huge help.
Excuse me, I've got to go warm up the orbital facepalm cannon.
Wait a minute. Is this a Civ 4 article?
I was wondering that.
It's gotta be.
Yeah, if it was Civ 4, this would be correct. In Civ 5, are you mental?
Yeah, seriously. Okay, every single world tile you put down costs you money.
Yeah, I war road to another civ. Okay, sure, fine. But everywhere? No.
Yeah, build them densely? Yeah. What? How to go broke.
Yeah. Were you planning on chieftaining and making those thousands of gold when you did this?
Yeah, no. You don't do that. If you want to have that income, you kind of have to not spam stuff that's unnecessary. That will cost you money. Roads are one of those things.
Even in Civ 4, it cost worker turns. Like, they didn't cost maintenance back then, and even then you didn't spam them until, like, you had your more important priorities done. But now that they cost maintenance?
No.
I can't picture ever having an empire with roads in every hex.
Well, although if you do want to be a jerk, you can get open borders with your neighbor and spam roads there.
trolling.
Yes, if you want to build some extra workers and troll your neighbors, sure. That you could probably do.
Yes, because the maintenance cost goes to the civilization whose territory it is on, not who built the road necessarily. Oops.
Yeah. Just keep in mind, neutral territory still counts as your own if you built a road. War roads, like Mackie said, yes, useful, especially for your siege units and stuff like that, because they're a little too slow sometimes, especially if there's a lot of rough terrain in between or stupid marsh, stuff like that. So yeah, you do want to get past that for if you're declaring war. Build them to a city-state. You only build it to a city-state if the city-state asks for the road in the first place.
Exactly.
Therefore, you get influence. If they don't, screw them.
Well, now, wait a minute. How expensive are these roads to the AI? Like, if you have a sprawling deity empire and you just carpet the whole thing in roads. I know this isn't very useful because it would take forever, but in theory, what kind of army could they still field if they had every hex roaded?
Well, it's one per. They do, on DD, get a reduction in costs, maintenance costs. So
yeah.
It would hurt them. And depending on if you can chop off their trade routes and other such stuff like that, there's a chance you can make them go negative or also go negative science.
Yeah, it's impractical, though.
You
would take a long time, a lot of workers, and a lot of maintenance of your own just to do that, just to maintain the workers, to spam roads within a reasonable time frame.
Yeah.
Just a funny thought.
Yeah.
As some of my fellow panelists have already talked about, yeah, having roads in the middle of a war is a huge help. But this statement, eventually you're going to go to war with them. You may not, absolutely. Necessarily go to war with them, but even if you do, you may be close enough to your neighbor and or farther enough along in the technology tree that the incremental increase in travel that you are going to get from the roads is not worth it. At the very least, it's certainly not worth it. Say, I'm probably going to have an industrial era war with this neighbor of mine. I think in medieval, I will construct roads in preparation of that.
Yeah.
You've spent so much money on maintenance and that time that the worker could not be building something else, like an improvement, building a farm or a mine or whatever, that costs you double now, both in maintenance and in time.
I am of the opinion that eventually you are going to go war with all your neighbors, because keep in mind, this is Civ 5. It is very likely that your neighbors will declare war on you at some point, even if they are your friend for half the game.
Well, then there's also the question, what kind of war are you going to have with that particular neighbor?
Nukes.
Even if I take it that, yes, okay, maybe you do eventually go to war with them, but if it's farther enough along and maybe more sea-based and air-based as opposed to roads, so in which case, not so much who cares, but even then, what's the point?
Yeah.
The next one, get real.
Many of the game's mods are hit or miss, but he really likes the RED Regiment and Ethnic Diversity Pack. It changes the scale of many units and makes them more diverse. So instead of there being one generic tank for all civs, for example, an American tank will be Sherman, a Russian tank a T-34. If you don't care about achievements or you're past all of that, guess it's not a bad thing, but it seems weird of all the mods to say that it's a necessity is the Regiment and Ethnic Diversity Pack. I would think it would be Info Addict or something like that, but...
Yeah, that's... you would think it'd be something else, but use a mod if you get bored with the game. But I don't know if it's a thing on a Get Real as a requirement to play Civ.
Yeah.
Like, more Golden Rule. Yeah, Golden Rule, look at mods, because apparently Golden Rule is that you want to mod the game, no matter who you are.
This is a good tip, but it's just not for this list. Like a flavor list.
Yeah.
And I guess next is Turtles, and not the Teenage Mutant Ninja kind.
I love Turtles.
Not so much.
Or those.
So, okay. While Civilization V offers you a vast variety of military units, for most of the game, you only need a handful. I'll just add in parentheses, especially if you have 60 or 70 roads. Whenever you're fighting a mobile turtle mix of infantry, such as warriors, swordsmen, riflemen, and siege weapons, such as catapults and cannons, provide the best mix, ditto for naval combat. For much of the game, you can get by with brute force amassing an armada of frigates and battleships, which are not only dominant at sea, but can also be a huge advantage for coastal warfare. You only need to diversify with air support, anti-air weapons, and fancy airdrop infantry once you hit the modern era.
So yeah. My 6 composite bows and 1 spearman to take the city would like to have a word with you.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I think tend to diversify less as the game goes on.
Although, well, if you're playing an archipelago, you could make a case for spamming frigates, I guess, but you know.
But also, once we get high enough into the tech tree, I can just drop a bunch of nukes and then drop a bunch of XCOM units, say.
Pew pew!
I think if you think of composite bows and X-bows as siege weapons, then this advice at least is a lot better than the last few topics we've looked at. Because it is roughly true. You want to have a couple people who can take the city, and then you want to probably even more ways of shooting at it from a distance. And later on, you do have to worry about anti-air, especially on the higher difficulty levels. It's not bad. It's not bad.
This is just, it's a little rough around the edges is all.
Yeah. And for the most part, yes, you only need a handful of units for most of the game, unless you're actually fighting, in which case you probably need to add a couple more. Siege units from cannons and up are useful, but then you also have to consider that air units, i.e. bombers, are also considered siege units at that point. Battleships, stuff like that. He's really focused on water because he keeps bringing sea stuff back. But I would agree, even on a Pangaea map, if your opponent is on the coast, then frigates and stuff like that are actually very useful, actually powerful than some of the stuff you can get on land, depending on the time frame.
And I'm probably the only person on the panel that interpreted it this way, and this is just a funny thing. When he talks about the mobile turtle mix of infantry, I know he's comparing different eras, but I couldn't help but think, like, simultaneously, you're going to have a mix of warriors, swordsmen, and riflemen.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, the rifleman's going to be like, I've got more material on my weapons than you have on your body, warrior. What the heck are we doing fighting together? But anyway.
He's got the healing promotion.
No.
He's our medic.
Yeah.
Give him a gun then.
Combat medic.
Give him a gun. Oh, wait, sorry. We have to give you a sword first, then we have to give you a long gun.
No, that's true.
Then we have to give you a crappy gun. All right, now you can hold the rifle.
There we go.
Oh, wait, did we have the iron for that sword? Because I'm pretty sure this I'm pretty sure this plastic one that we can make might not work.
That is so annoying.
Yeah.
That not being able to upgrade because you have no iron.
But anyways.
Yeah, don't spy, but this is qualified as much in brackets.
There's always easier espionage units to spy on other civs, but just because they're called spies doesn't mean they need to spy. Stealing checks can be slow and dangerous and only really useful if there's one civ way ahead of you. In most other cases, it's better to split your spies between rigging the elections of nearby city-states, helping cement your hold over them, and employing them as diplomats, because buying votes for World Congress is a lot more important than the odd free tech. Are you mental?
Actually, okay, so he saved himself from that last sentence.
I thought we were ignoring city-states.
The actual advice, if you ignore the rest of the article for the last sentence, is true. Sometimes it just does take way too long to actually steal a tech, and so you might as well rig the election of a city-state or coup it. And employing them as diplomats is only useful at the point in time where diplomats are necessary, but yes, buying votes for World Congress is a lot more important than not, although it's not more important than the odd free tech, but if it's going to take you that 1,036 turns to steal the tech because the game decided to bork up the calculation, you might as well go buy their votes to get something else. So yes, you don't just use your spies for stealing techs, although being dangerous, who cares, because you just get a new one anyways, and then you can send them back to do the same thing. But you do want to steal techs where you can.
Yeah, where you can. There are going to be those situations where there isn't anything left for you to steal, but even if you have him there as a spy before you get to globalization and he can be a diplomat, he's still giving you visibility on a city. So
and letting you know if they're building things or building up an army. And
exactly.
Yes, there are other things to do with spies other than stealing tech.
And then there's be cool, man.
Cool, man, be cool. There's always the temptation to be a conqueror, constantly invading your neighbors. It's understandable because it's fun. But if you're playing on a bigger map with lots of civs, it's just not worth it. You'll develop a reputation as a bit of a monster, and that's not a reputation you want to have when the modern eras roll around and you need to regularly count on the other civs' votes. No, do not be cool. Conquer it all.
You only want to be cool if you're not going for domination and you care a lot about the votes. If you're not going diplomatic, then the votes only matter in so far that, you know, you got to keep a couple AIs happy, or you just need to get all the city-states. You can have all the AIs on the map hate you and still diplo. You can win other ways and have the AI hate you.
Yeah. Other ways to win diplo. Can we talk about the whole city-state thing again?
Yeah. Otherwise, if you do have everybody on the map hating you, then there's less trade possibilities, there's more chance that you're fighting them all constantly, and while you're wanting to build a military to take on a couple AIs, you probably don't want to build a military to take on all of the AIs, because that will hurt you long-term.
At once in particular.
Yeah. Plus, they can be jerks, and eventually, if they all hate you, turn around and basically embargo you so that you can't send trade routes out.
Rule Britannia.
Woo.
There's so much variety to be had in the game's civilizations, so many perks designed to cater to an individual's playstyle, that saying a single one is better than others would be foolish. My favorite, though, is the English. The extra naval movement bonus you get is a big help when you're exploring, especially if it's stacked on top of other plus one movement perks like the Great Lighthouse. And extra spy can make a huge difference, and the ship of the line is just a beast. So we're back to the water maps.
Okay. Now we know he likes navigation so much.
Yeah, if you're playing them all the time. Yeah, I'd love navigation too if I were Britain.
Why don't we extrapolate this, because it's a golden rule, which is, depending upon your preferred play style, how you think you are going to win the game, then at times choose a civilization that is your favorite, and it's your favorite because it puts you in the best position in order to pursue that victory condition. An example of this could be the English on water style based maps, which is my favorite. It's just, like, it's not badly written, don't get me wrong, but it still, again, seems very skewed.
Yeah.
His advice is very unique to his, like, of both England and naval apps, rather than being what he tried to write about, which was general golden rules.
I could see that maybe this started off as a golden rule article, but then once he's finished writing it as an editor, I would either say, Luke, who wrote this article, you need to revise this, the content of what you've written, or Luke, we're not going to market this as a tips for playing Civilization 5. We're going to market this as a flavor article for Civilization 5 based on how you like to play. Because a lot of our criticisms here, I would say, come back to what he said at the very beginning. These are golden rules. They are not golden rules.
Except for maybe this last one.
Fuck Attila. Seriously, he's the worst. I'd have to say Shaka before Attila, but I feel his pain. I'm not going to harsh his buzz there. I'm cool with that.
Yeah, I will put Attila in the camp of Santa will not be visiting him anytime soon. He's on the naughty list from Santa. Okay, fair enough. Recorded for episode 210 with Dan Q, the Me and Team, Matt Jin, Darkest Onion, and Eek. Still in Civilization 5, John Yoga is his username, although he does sign his opening post as Mark. He says, what brave new world, so this is the second expansion pack for Civilization 5, quirks, exploits, loopholes, and IMBAs, those are imbalances, did I miss, or are patched out and no longer work? Just on these terms, on the show in the past, we've often talked about balance, and we often talk about exploits. We don't so much hear the term quirk or loopholes, especially quirk, actually, when it comes to gameplay. And so for my scale, in terms of things that I read, and then if I agree with you, it's an issue. If it's an exploit, that's at the top of my list of should not be. Then loopholes and imbalances, you can kind of flip because there are different degrees of imbalances and loopholes. And then the quirks thing is just kind of like whatever. If I agree that something is a quirk, I probably don't have a particularly strong opinion one way or another about it. He listed 9, and there were some other ones that came up in the thread. Focus on these 9 as well as 9 that came up later in the thread by Tetley. His first one, and again, this is John Yoga. Maritime city-states. With an alliance, you get +3 food in your capital and +1 food for every other city you have. This can be a bit unfair if you have a wide civilization. Yes, other players, including the AI, have the advantage of using this with the maritime city-states too, but this is not my point. It seems like an imbalance function. I don't think that's imbalanced at all. That's called strategy?
I don't have a problem with that one myself. I just watch out for what I call the ethical thin ice when looking at an exploit, like he talks about in the thread.
Ethical thin ice.
Yeah, I mean, is anyone on the panel, this is a bad thing, that's something we need to do something about?
What?
Exactly.
What? Food. More food? I don't have a problem.
Number 2. Click on the honor social policy, have an archer outside of each barb encampment, kill the barbs that spawn for culture bonus, but don't knock off the encampment. You also gain experience, which can make your archers fairly powerful early in the game if you do this a bit much. As John C. Nunn points out, you max out on the XP.
Yep.
There's also the fact, and I know we've talked about this on the show before, if that's what you're using your archer for, does your archer really not have something better it could be doing?
No, in this case, the opener of honor SP is actually useful for something?
That is true.
Well, must be nerfed down. Can't have it.
Can't have honor actually be worth taking.
Well, for me, this is right on the line, because, like, if you're just doing it for the XP, that's fine. But to me, it doesn't become an exploit until you turn on Raging Barbarians and then go do it.
An exploit or anything. This is actually purposely built into the game. Honor opener gives you culture from killing barbs. If you choose to leave the barb camp there and just sit there and farm them, you actually made honor worth taking.
This is a quirk.
Except, did you really?
It's not that big a deal.
Social policies.
Well, now it depends. When are you clicking on the honor social policy to open this up and start doing it?
Yeah.
If it's mid to late game, no.
Well,
but early on in the game, for that snowball effect, for all that culture you can accumulate and then start rushing through some social policies early on, heck to the yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess because you don't have to continue down honor very much or at all necessarily. So if you got Raging Barbs on, yeah, go for it.
Well, it just acts as that kind of setting the game up to win before you start. That's why I kind of get on that kind of divide line for me.
Yeah, but that's like single player strats anyway. Like in multiplayer, someone could just come and kill your unit. It's not that big
or
of a deal.
Or just take out the barb camp like has happened on Turncast, where rage has therefore ensued. You took out my barb camp. I was farming that.
Or they could just take you out. I mean, there's lots of options.
Right.
And then the next question is it worth farming barb camps? Is that a design thing?
It's a diminishing returns.
Well, actually, the volume of culture you get from the barbs goes up over time. It's based on combat strength of the barb units, and with barbs being able to kick out muskets at some point, that does get more.
There is that, but there's also the diminishing returns on the fact there's fewer and fewer places for barbs to be found.
Yeah, but that's true. You've protected all the barb camps you found and keep AIs from just wandering their scout through to the barb camp anyways, because they will.
Number 3, when at war, pillage a tile, fix it with your worker for gold, then pillage the tile, then fix it with your worker for gold, rinse and repeat.
Jeez.
I read somewhere that you can pillage your own resources and repair them for the same gold loop. No, but I don't think this is possible. I haven't tried this either.
First, let's move some words over. So the for gold, move that to after pillage a tile for gold.
Yes.
Fix it with your worker, pillage the tile for gold. The way it reads is like you just paid to improve the tile.
That's true. Yes, yes. This is a loophole.
Yes, you shouldn't be able to improve tiles in foreign territory when you're at war.
Well, I mean, I've used it in single player to bring a combat engineer to cheese it up and multi-pillage while I'm attacking, so I can make bad decisions when attacking cities. It's not optimal. I mean, I just do it because the whole...
It doesn't seem like it's strong enough to merit, like, exploit treatment. You have to bring a worker over there or like steal one to do it anyway.
That's not hard. They're all over the place. And there are civs and or units that give extra gold from pillaging.
That's true.
And if you go liberty with the pyramids and blah, 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 stack up your worker speed, especially on quick speed, you can fix that improvement in a single turn. And if you have a unit that can pillage without wasting their movement, then you can pillage, improve, pillage.
You're talking about a lot of setup for this, though.
That's not hard when you're getting a lot of money. Like, if you actually have units that can give you multiple of the income, then yes, you can sit there on space far enough away from a city to not be attacked so that you're just basically pillaging that third or fourth ring improvement constantly.
Yeah, to me, what keeps this from becoming an exploit is not so much the fact that you can have lots of units in the vicinity to be able to take advantage of this situation, but just the situation itself. You're not always going to find a situation where you can do this, or there's always not going to be a situation where it's going to be optimal to do this as opposed to, I don't know, keep on moving the units and take out the actual city and get gold that way and territory.
Also, I mean, if you're playing the optimal rush up to artillery kind of domination victory, you really shouldn't be worrying about pillaging enough to bring a worker, is what I'm saying.
Or at the very least, wait until you take a city which maybe has a worker in it already.
Right, exactly.
And then you're like, oh, okay, well, you're already here. You might as well fix an improvement you might have very well built when you belonged to that other civ.
Yeah, I tend to do it when I already have a worker from a city I've taken, rather than sending somebody, you know, the hard way across the map with the units.
Number four is kind of one of those used to be an issue, but not anymore. Not that I would know anything about this one. Sell everything to a civ, gain gold, etc. Then go to war with the civ and get it all back.
Oh my god.
As Lindsay40k point out, you need this thing called a declaration of friendship now to receive lump sums of money. I mean, yeah, you could say, well, I can get gold per turn, so I'll wait a few turns and get a few gold per turn. Yeah, but that is a fraction of what you could get over a lump sum. Then you could say, okay, well, I'll get a declaration of friendship, and then instead of 200 gold, I'll just get 2 or 3 gold a turn until I reach the 200 gold and then declare. That does not have the same impact at all. That's not an exploit, that's not a loophole, that's not an imbalance, that's not a quirk anymore. That's been there, done that.
Right, well, I figure on higher level play, if you're making friendships, getting the money, and then backstabbing, you're kind of asking for a war, so you better be ready to go domination victory. You do that more than once.
Yeah, that and or combination of you better hope who you're pissing off is very far away from you right now to be able to do something, and hopefully you've got some maybe some city-states that you can trade with now because everyone else is at war with you and you can protect those trade routes, etc., etc. Yeah, that's much more diminishing returns now, speaking of. Number five, buy off city-states for their alliances right before the United Nations meet to win Diplo victory. Imbalance, but I wouldn't say that's an exploit.
It's a design flaw?
I mean,
which
I guess
a slightly different rebel?
Yeah.
I guess I'd say I wish you couldn't do it, but I do do it. So
instead of doing that, just bully city states now. I'm good. Number six, to get quote unquote free worker, especially during the early game when they're turn expensive, declare war on a city state, steal their worker, then declare peace. Okay, that is an imbalance in the sense that you can get peace immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's an exploit. You might be able to say it's exploitable because of a snowball effect, but I just think it's an imbalance. If it was, hey, fine, you go ahead and you take the worker, then if at the very least we couldn't immediately get peace, even if someone could argue, well, who cares if you get peace right away or not? What the heck's a city-state going to do? That would still be better than the present circumstance, but I don't think this is as bad as the person who started this thread is making it out to be.
Right. I mean, I think it's ethical, the way I look at things, but at the same time, you can kick a nasty diplomacy hit if you forget to check that it's protected by one of your neighbors, like Shaka.
I don't see any ethical issue here. You're merely choosing an off-my strategy that is given to you as a clear option from the get-go.
Something that is no longer applicable. Number seven, the research blocking technique, where you have the game aim to give you the tech you want when a research agreement expires. And he said, someone please explain. John C. Nunn said, obsolete with Gods and Kings, if not a very late patch to vanilla, which changed the research agreement to a median value. And then Brave New World has since changed this to a minimum value. If we were talking about this before, yeah, but been there, done that. Number eight, If Austria end at war with a civ that is closer to an allied city-state than it is to you, gift your units to that city-state, then buy that city-state. It will teleport your troops back to the battlefield, so to speak. John C. Nunn says, it takes a few turns to teleport, and also the city-state has a chance to disband on arrival. To me, this is a quirk.
Well, yeah. For me, the teleporting units, I mean, just breaks my mind a bit. I'm trying to picture how they suddenly arrive in three turns. You know, it sounds weird, I guess, but for me, that feels cheaty.
Well, if we want to talk about teleport, I'm thinking more of those, hey, I've got a unit or several units of mine deep within your empire because we had open borders. Hey, war's been declared. Woo, look at that. I went halfway across the map. Cool.
Sweet. Magic movement.
Now that.
Yeah.
I don't even know if there's a practical solution, because where are you going to put them? Oh, well, the nearest available tile that is not owned by that particular civ is water. Blub, 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 blub.
Yeah. Oh. Technically, you're not going to get all of the units. So say you take all your units and you sell them like 30 units and then buy the CS. You're not actually going to get those units. Plus, all those units, they will have all lost all promotions.
There is that too.
All those units that get sent there, you have to be careful, for one. They need the space to put it, and the space has to be around the capital. Otherwise, there's no place to put it, and all of a sudden, it just kind of disappears. And they might just delete it, because if you give them a high volume of units, they may just sell them, because it's too many units.
They can't support them, yeah.
Yeah.
But number nine, okay, John Yoga. This is a nasty MP thing that I just read about. Player A trade offers to player B. Player B modifies the trade request to whatever he wants to steal from player A. Player B closes the trade window, reopens it, sees player one's proposal, and accepts it. From some weird game glitch, player B now has all trade items he placed in his modified list.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's up there and don't do that territory for me.
Yeah.
I think right now it's kind of an MP. You just don't
It's a
do that.
Multiplayer only bug. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
That
kind of stuff tends to make you unpopular in MP pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Right. I wouldn't do that.
It's like a short change trick. You know, passing the funny 20.
Yeah. It's like, it's also the, hey, look, you just use this in a game kick.
That, and it's also not one of those, oh, sorry, I just accidentally clicked on one thing and it happened kind of things. It's no. There was thought that went into that. Sorry. Oops, I just accidentally did this and then did that and then this and then that. My bad.
Mm-hmm. Oops.
Sounds legit.
To that I say take off, eh?
Like, do not invite next game. Make note.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, remove from context, even. And then lastly for this, from Tetley, he himself lists nine. I believe there's an exploit for the patronage finish so that they gift you a great person every three turns. And Lindsay40K says, I think I recently read that this has passed away. What? I've never heard of it. Was that an issue? What?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Did anyone ever hear of that? I don't ever remember that being patched away because I don't remember it ever existing.
I don't remember hearing of that. But if you could actually get a great person every three turns, then yeah, that'd be a little strong.
Sounds like a Civ urban legend to me.
I didn't think it was that frequent, not even regardless of game speed. I didn't think it was every three turns.
No.
There would have had to have been some sort of bug or glitch that was causing that.
A lot of city-states.
As Eeg said, maybe it was a measure of a particular situation where there are so many city-states that you can ally, and they are allied with you, or that they have contact with you, that you're going to then get them. But yeah, that seems pretty situational.
Yeah.
Number two, instead of gifting units to a city-state to help them survive, send in your own units as peacekeepers, and he puts peacekeepers in quotation marks, to disrupt the attack. The AI may have 20 units ready to go in, but because your own cavalry is sitting the way he can only send five, the city-state survives and rips the enemy army to shred piecemeal. Okay, yes, I have done this. I like this. This is a quirk. Is it cheesy? Is it a bit trolly? Yeah, but is it an exploit? Is it a loophole? Is it imbalanced? I don't think so.
Well,
single player strats only.
Yeah. Multiplayer.
You just get killed
like,
for it in multiplayer.
Yeah. Multiplayer would be like, hey, look, I'll just kill your units now.
It's like, oh, willing to have your units die to protect your city state friend, whether it's a formal friend or not? Okay.
Yeah, and see, in single player, I don't know where you draw the line and stuff like this, so I just don't draw one. Because, let's face it, the AI sucks. The AI gets tons of bonuses, and no matter what you're doing, really, you're basically exploiting the AI's limitations to some degree, because it's just not good at the game, and so it's relying on bonuses to try and overpower that deficiency. There's just no way. Like, does that offer more utility than things that people do routinely in single player? I don't think so. You know, it's a niche thing. You can use it sometimes. Sometimes it really makes a difference, but almost never does it really change the outcome of a game very much. So, like, to me, it's a little iffy, but...
And if it does change the outcome of the game, is it really that rage-inducing?
Well, I try not to shake my finger. People don't do that in single player. I don't want to lecture. But when I start seeing it in MP, I start going, hey, do that again in my next game, and we'll have a stronger talk.
But in MP, you can just kill someone's unit. Like, it doesn't matter.
But I mean, I've seen people in MP do things like declare peace in the middle of a war that's not going well, gift a city to an AI, back up behind it, and now give me a situation where I got to beat through an AI, declare war on them to get to my opponent.
Yeah, that's a different case, though.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Number three on Tetley's list is actually related to the second one. Peacekeeper disruption also works protecting major civs, especially with open borders, or if you yourself are technically at war with the victim.
Yes.
What's
you can get in the way.
You can get in the way. Isn't that kind of, you know, if I protect my friend, then kind of like my friend is between myself and this other guy. I'd rather not have the other guy on my borders. So let's stop them before they get to that point, as an example. Yeah. Is that a quirk? I don't think that's a quirk, but okay, let's call it a quirk. That's the best I'd give it.
Besides, you do have some alternative uses for those units that are at least sometimes better.
Sometimes better. Just like cookies are sometimes food, or sometimes better. There's this, and then late game. You can sell puppets to weakling civs whom you have influential tourism over. Retaking them carries very little penalty.
Another borderline for me.
Okay, so...
Well, I'll explain a bit. I mean, well...
Quirk?
I would say almost a quirk. I think I'll go with you there. But it just seems like you're setting up again. You know, repeating the same city, take, take, take. Seems kind of immersion breaking, I guess is what I'm really saying.
Number eight, after you complete a build a road city-state quest, undo the road and the quest might come back. Okay, I've never seen this. I've never tried this. I laughed. This was the one that I read and I laughed. And I thought, especially the end might come back. If it always came back, okay, I could maybe see an argument for an imbalance because then, hey, let's restore it and I'm just going to get instant more influence with the city-state. But come on, that's another quirk at, you know, at most.
Your manpower reserves need to recover.
Yep.
Your manpower reserves have recovered. Your manpower.
Yeah. The problem is I'm reasonably sure that the road quest doesn't even show up much anymore.
It's really rare from what I've seen, too.
Plus, the city-state is a dick about actually building the road inside its own borders, so have fun even getting there first. You pay for the road to nowhere, basically. So I'm not really against pillaging that road once the quest is over, because otherwise you're paying for a road to nowhere and you're getting nothing out of it anymore.
Right.
So the last one here. Okay, I'm going to try to say this without laughing. Maybe people are going to say, Dan, this is awfully mean. That's an awfully mean preface. I try not to be harsh, but whew. Road and railroad spam your friends with whom you have open borders with.
Yeah, friends.
Yeah.
Okay. And of course, they're kind of getting to, they must mean when you say road and railroad spam your friends, as in the road and railroad is within their territory, and say, hey, want more maintenance cost? Want more maintenance cost? More maintenance cost? Yeah, your friends. Okay, if this is happening in MP, then whoever you're playing against is, I don't understand what is going on here. But after a while, it's just kind of like, again, okay, you could do that and then say, look at all this maintenance cost I'm putting onto the AI. But then it's, okay, even if you set aside for the fact that you are also paying maintenance on the worker, does your worker not have something better to do? Like, there's a difference between occasionally doing that and spam, because spam to me is just over and over and over and over and over, and that just seems kind of pointless.
Well, this is another one I'm kind of iffy on. I mean, if you could cancel open borders treaties like in multiplayer, if someone started doing it, then I'd be a little happier with this tactic. Because otherwise you got to sit there and keep have it happening while you watch that thing tick down as they keep doing it.
Again, this comes down to something with the whole, you know, previous improving stuff. Just don't let workers improve things in neighbors' territory. If it's not inside your territory, or for the case of Rhodes, in neutral territory, you can't build there. That solves both at the same time, and we don't have to worry about it anymore.
And I'd even take away city-state road building quests, since the city-state won't always build, like you said a minute ago.
Yeah.
The roads towards you.
Mostly jerks, so.
Yeah. I would rather they fix it rather than take it away, but, you know, okay.
I still think they're jerks. Or make it so that it gives you a bonus per turn that it's still there.
Go with the positive reinforcement. I like that.
Yeah, you get plus 0.5 influence per turn if you leave a road there.
That could work.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Record dates assorted, 2014. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.